Simone Sanders Townsend and I have known each other for more than a decade, tussling over politics and policy when she worked in the White House and I reported on it.
And now we're friends and colleagues, and on our podcast, Clock It, we are positioning ourselves at the intersection of culture and politics.
Clock It is where we talk about what we see and hear in the news, so you can start to clock it too.
Clock It with Simone and Eugene. All episodes available now.
Welcome to Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams. I grew up in Gulfport, Mississippi, and that meant that most evenings, the family watched one of two television stations, either ABC or PBS. Because we couldn't afford cable, those were the choices. In certain parts of the country back then, cable included NBC, CBS, and the like. Well, on Saturdays, that meant that the local ABC affiliate, WLOX, ran the show Hee Haw. And I laughed every Saturday. If we were watching PBS, I would sometimes grudgingly tolerate the music of the Grand Ole Opry and occasionally maybe hum along. Yet as a teenager, I boasted to a friend that I hated country music. And she rightly asked why. And I did not have an answer. I was just used to saying, oh, I hate country music. But when I'm challenged, I like to make sure I have a good answer. So for the next month, as a teenager, I made myself listen to every station on the radio, including the local country station. And it turns out I love country music. I love the storytelling, the pathos, the harmonies. And like so many, having immersed myself in country music, it turns out I loved Dolly Parton. She was the epitome of contradiction. She was glamorous and humble. She was flippant, but she had this extraordinary depth. In 1995, Dolly Parton started the Imagination Library. She started it for her father, Robert Lee Parton, who could not read or write, and whom she called the smartest man she ever knew. When I learned that, I felt a kinship with her that I hadn't expected. You see, my dad, Robert Lee Abrams, had undiagnosed dyslexia. Now, imagine being a young Black boy in segregated schools in Mississippi without access to an IEP, without anyone to explain what was happening. My dad couldn't read, yet he was a brilliant storyteller who struggled to read and write, but who enjoyed every minute that he could make his way through a book, tell a good story. Well, what she did for the Robert Lees of the South, Robert Lee Parton and Robert Lee Abrams, in their name, was transformative. You see, her idea was simple. Mail a book every month to any child under five for free. No application, no proof of poverty, no means testing. By August of 2026, this program has mailed more than 332 million books. Dolly Parton started a library. My dad married a librarian, my mom. I wanted to share that parallel because we are in a moment of mourning, but this is one of those places where I too celebrate Dolly Parton's genius. Dolly built a partnership that eschewed normal charity in favor of collaboration because she knew that free could be discounted. Instead, the Dollywood Foundation pays the administrative cost. That means the machinery, the vendors, the book selection. But the books themselves and the postage get covered by local partners and, in most states, a state match, half from the community and half from the government. She fronted the hard part, and she asked the public to invest in the children on the other side of the bargain. But despite the public panegyrics that are pouring in from politicians, many of whom are claiming kinship with Dolly Parton, these are the same people who are currently slashing away at her legacy. Across the country, red and blue states are cutting funding for the Imagination Library. Legislatures and governors acting on our behalf are rejecting a proven solution to isolation, illiteracy, and deficiency thinking. As we are told to trust the private sector to help us figure out how to solve problems, we keep forgetting the partnership, that it's not just the private, It's the private and the public. You see, in this case, a private citizen proved a public good work. She proved it at scale. She proved it cheaply. She proved it in red counties and blue cities. And instead of the state taking the lesson, the states right now are taking the exit. We like to praise the generosity in exact proportion to how much it relieves us of the obligation, and that is not right. Because when the money vanishes, we then say it's a tough budget year instead of what it is. This is a decision that toddlers are the least expensive thing to stop paying for. I spent 11 years in the Georgia General Assembly, 7 of them as minority leader in the House. And look, I read a great number of budgets, way too many. A line item in a state budget is one of the most honest statements a legislature ever makes, because it tells you precisely who they believe they owe and for whom they think they are responsible. Now, one of my most controversial actions as minority leader in Georgia was negotiating with a Republican governor to preserve a pre-K program at the expense of reducing a scholarship for college students. Now, there are those who decried the bargain, and they had their reasons, and they weren't wrong. But I had mine. And at its core, it was that I know 4-year-olds don't get a do-over. Dolly Parton understood that, not because she was a movement leader or that she ever claimed to be. In fact, she kept her distance from endorsements and turned back ideological framing, often with a wry quip and a really cheery smile. But if you watch what she did with her own money and her own name, you know she believed in justice. In 2018, she took Dixie out of the stampede, saying that attitudes change. In 2020, when she was asked about protests, she told Billboard, "Of course, Black Lives Matter." She put $1 million into Vanderbilt research that helped underwrite the Moderna vaccine. And she put a second $1 million into pediatric infectious disease. And in February 2021, when Tennessee legislators filed a bill to erect a statue of her on Capitol grounds, grounds that it spent many years arguing over whom they should honor, she asked them not to. She said, quote, "Given all that is going on in the world, I don't think putting me on a pedestal is appropriate at this time." When Buffy the Vampire Slayer, one of my favorite shows, was coming into being, it was Dolly Parton who became a producer of the show that said that every young girl had the potential to save the world. You see, Dolly Parton understood the assignment. A statue is a great deal cheaper than a book budget, an investment in cultural narrative, or a hard decision to speak aloud about our values. And so here it is, my tribute to Dolly Parton. And that tribute is homework for you. First, I want you to help save the local match that has helped keep the Imagination Library viable and whole. Local affiliates raise half the money. So I need you to find yours at imaginationlibrary.com and give to it. Because in a match state, every dollar you put in is a dollar you obligate the state to spend on your behalf. Number two, I want state budgets to be top of mind for you, because for the next fiscal year, those budgets are already being drafted right now in the fall before the session opens. By the time the session starts, I'm here to tell you they've already made most of their decisions. So call your state legislator, not your congressman, your state legislator, and specifically call the ones who sit on appropriations or on education. Ask them whether the Imagination Library line item survives, and then ask them to say the answer out loud in public, especially at an event asking you for your vote this November. And number three, this is step 8 of the 10 steps to freedom and power. It is that we have to engage. If your governor put out a feel-good statement about Dolly Parton, call that office and ask what their book budget is. I need us to understand power is made real when it is used for good, not for show. Dolly Parton didn't want the pedestal. She wanted books to keep coming. So don't build her a monument. Pay for the postage. Later in the show, I'm going to speak with California Attorney General Rob Bonta about new developments in major cases like his lawsuit against Meta and all of the ways our states can fight back against this administration and this regime. But first, I am joined by Congresswoman LaMonica McIver, who is facing three federal charges after an arrest while conducting a legal oversight visit to the ICE Detention Center, Delaney Hall. This week, a court declined to dismiss the case against her, stating that she was not protected by legislative immunity despite being at Delaney Hall to do her job. Congresswoman LaMonica McIver, welcome to Assembly Required.
Thank you. It's good to see you, Stacey. It's great to be on.
I appreciate having you. I know this has been a tough couple of weeks, and before we dive into last week's court ruling, I want to ground us in why we're having this conversation, and that is that we have seen these horrendous decisions made by not just this administration, but this regime, and particularly around immigration. Can you talk about the conditions at Delaney Hall and why congressional oversight of ICE facilities is so important in this moment?
Absolutely. Well, it seems like it's been years since I've been to back since last May, but literally just last May of 2025 was my first visit to Delaney Hall. And literally since that day, it has been nothing but cruelty and chaos at this detention center, from detainees being denied medical assistance, medical care, from moldy food to not getting any food at all, from sexual assaults to abuse on detainees. It has just been absolutely horrible. We are up to three deaths that have happened at this detention center due to detainees not receiving medical attention. And it just continues to get bad each and every day there. Those were the conditions I saw last May. And since then, it has escalated. And this is why oversight is so important, so that you know, members of Congress, we have the right to go into these detention centers to have oversight. And when you get there, you get to uncover the truths, you know, and the reality and the cruelty that is happening in these detention centers. And that is why oversight is so important.
I mean, one of the issues I have with this current moment is how our language has started to shift away and drift away from what's happening. And I think what you have done about oversight and just remaining present is so important. I had the opportunity to be in Dilley, Texas, outside the prison camp they have for children and families. And we knew that inside there was an 18-month-old who, you know, nearly lost her life because they refused to give her medication, and the child ended up on life support, that kids were being denied food and medical care, and that these are children, that these detainees, as you pointed out, they are not criminals. They are not people who have been, you know, actually found and adjudicated of committing a crime. And yet they have become less and less relevant in our current conversation about who we want to be as a country. And I'm going to step off my soapbox and let you step on it, because I want to ask you, like, what do you want people to know about how we should be thinking about and talking about the current state of ICE enforcement, especially given that we are heading into midterms?
Well, I think one, there is, and you said it so, you know, eloquently, there is this perceived emotion that many of these people are here illegally, right? And Delaney Hall, there are tons of detainees that I've spoken to that literally are here on approved student visas, approved work visas, TPS status, and they've done nothing wrong. They have no criminal record. They follow all of our proper immigration processes and policies here in this country. And let alone, they've still been detained, denied due process, literally waiting months and months, some over a year, for a court hearing, let alone. And this is what's happening. They're being kidnapped off of the street with, you know, approved status from this country has given that to them, and being held against their will. And some of them being killed in these locations, being mistreated. And it's awful that, you know, your tax dollars and the American people's tax dollars are paying for this type of cruelty that is happening and this injustice that is happening among the immigration community. I had a young girl by the name of Ariana, who was a senior, Stacey, who was detained. She had a court order with no action, for her immigration status for the moment until a certain period of time. And she was a senior at one of my district high schools here, who was picked up, held for months, missed her high school prom, missed her high school graduation, literally being mistreated in this detention center for no apparent reason. And we were eventually able to get her out after months of trying. And she spent the whole summer trying to recoup to get her high school diploma, to go to summer school. And she was successful for doing that. But she deserves justice, right? She deserves justice for what they have done to her, because she can't get that time back. She can't get high school prom back and high school graduation back. And it's just so unfair. It's unfair that she had to go through this and they did this to her. And that's why, you know, we have to continue to make the American people understand what is really happening at these places, who these individuals really are, and the justice that needs to happen for them, because this is not right. This is not just that we're operating like this, and we have to call that out, and people have to be held responsible and accountable at some point, Stacey, for their actions.
And Congresswoman, you use the word justice, and I think it's an important frame for us to hold here. You serve as a member of Congress, a co-equal branch of government that is imbued with the responsibility at the local level for being the voice and the eyes and ears of the people in your community. They hire you as a congresswoman. They send you to Washington to vote, but they expect you to be at home doing that job and looking at what is being done in their name. And yet you are facing criminal charges. Can you explain the court's recent rationale in refusing to dismiss the charges against you?
We took this case, this, you know, request to dismiss these charges to the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And literally, we've been saying it from day one. I have legislative immunity because, as folks know, I showed up there to do my job, to conduct an oversight visit. I wasn't there for a protest, wasn't there for, as the governor, as the Department of Justice said, to break people out or harm anyone. I was there for an oversight visit with two of my other colleagues here from New Jersey. And we asked for these charges to be dismissed at the local judge level, and then we asked for them to be dismissed at the Third Circuit Court of Appeals. And it was a 2-to-1 opinion that came out that basically said these charges, two of the three charges, can go forward, with one being needing more information. And so now we're in, you know, continuing in this battle. I've been dealing with these charges for over a year now. And basically, Trump's Department of Justice is saying, you cannot go and do your job. Like, you don't get the opportunity to do that as a member of Congress. We will make up these false, you know, claims, create this chaos and this situation, and then, you know, charge you for doing so. And that's the reason why we keep going back to oversight. And the point that this is not about LaMonica McIver, Stacey, alone. This is about members of Congress, every member of Congress, because we're doing our job on behalf of the people that elected us to do so. We're the voices for the people that we elect, and we have to hold this administration accountable. And that's what people expect for us to do, protecting them and fighting for them. And if an executive branch can get away with creating this, you know, situation and then charging me, they can do this to any member of Congress. And it takes away the voices of the people that we represent. And that's why this case is extremely important, bigger than me. And, you know, we're still in a fight and still in a stretch of this situation.
I mean, one of the things we talk about in the 10 Steps campaign that I launched that helps Americans understand what authoritarianism looks like here. It's not the same as in Turkey or Hungary or Brazil or India, but it shares a common DNA. And one of the steps, in fact, the third step in an authoritarian regime, is that you weaken competing powers. You attack Congress and you weaken how Congress can operate. And we've seen that play out primarily through just the complicity of Republicans in Congress who have disavowed any actual responsibility for managing the chambers they control. But what you're pointing out is one of the other ways you weaken those competing powers. You strip a co-equal branch of government using the third branch of government, the courts. You strip Congress of its ability to hold the executive accountable. And that removal of authority is absolutely part of the authoritarian push, as is targeting people that the regime deems to be a political enemy. And that's core to the project. You can't hold absolute power if there are people trying to take that power back. And do you see your prosecution as part of this effort, as you being in that legion of political enemies that this regime has drawn and has been willing to attack?
Absolutely, I do. I mean, I think that's part of the purpose and the reason of this all. You know, many people, lawyers, I'm not a lawyer, but people come. I mean, I might as well be a lawyer now, Stacey, after all of this I had to go through. But, you know, many people say to me, a lot of lawyers, like, hey, do they think they're going to get like a conviction in this? If this goes to trial, like a jury, do they think this? Or, you know, and I'm like, I don't know what they think. But at the end of the day, it's not about what they think of the end result. It is the process that's the punishment. That's where the pain is at. Mm-hmm. You know, I've had to raise money for this case because members of Congress can't get pro bono legal help. I've had to take time out of my work that I'm doing for the people of the 10th Congressional District here in New Jersey to be on calls with lawyers, to go to court multiple times. Not to mention I'm a mom, I'm a wife. So it's been so time consuming, painful and exhausting. And this is what they literally want to display, right? This is the point of it all. But it also does something that you mentioned. It scares people. It scares other members of Congress as well for standing up in some cases thinking, hey, I don't want to be in this situation. I don't want to be battling 17 years in prison for, you know, being critical of this administration or standing up to them. And so it does all of those things. And I think that's the point of it all is to scare people and to stop them, you know, literally from doing their jobs, but also to just the regular American people, right? Seeing this happen, you know, is just frustrating and it's disheartening and sad and scary. And this is what they want to implement at the end of the day with this administration.
I mean, I was having a conversation last week with a young woman. She's a college junior who said that she and her friends talk about why they won't protest. And it's because they've seen students get deported, get detained. They've seen violence against young people and they don't want to risk it. And the conversation we had, I pointed out that part of the nature of protest is that there is risk. There's always risk involved. And I'd love for you to respond to this, that it's not that you can protest without risk. It is that you have to calculate your risk and you have to decide how much you can afford to lose.
Yeah.
And I would ask you this, and I don't mean to set it up in a binary fashion, but having known you for a while, knowing now what you know, would you have decided not to visit Delaney Hall, recognizing that they would weaponize your actual power against you and use it to put you in the position you're in, to put your family in the position that it's in?
It's a question that I tuggle with all the time, Stacey. I mean, literally. But at the same time, I would do it all over again because of the simple fact that we have got to have the courage and the braveness that we need to stand up to this dictatorship of a administration and president that we have. If we don't have the few that are standing up, what are we going to do? We're going to lie down and allow this to be our reality for the future? I think not. You know, I have a 10-year-old daughter. I have a baby growing in the womb right now. And I want to make sure that I am fighting, thank you, fighting for them as much as I can to leave a better world for them, not just for my children, but for the American people's children, for their children's children, you know, for everyone. And so at the end of the day, you know, it's my job to stand up and protect people, not just the folks who are in Delaney Hall, but those families who called me in the first place about their loved ones at Delaney Hall. And that's the reason why I went there, because I was getting calls about this facility. And so at the end of the day, we have to have the courage. And I think you laid it out great. You have to pick what you are able, the lane you're able to be into, what you're willing to sacrifice for. But as I remind my people in my district every day, the power is still with them. And I think people are being so torn into pieces these days right now. It's so exhausting and stressful of everything that folks are going through that they lose sight that they still hold the power. They still can elect people and unelect people. And, you know, because they have their voices, I encourage them to do so. And, you know, they should continue to do do so. What I'm going through is a bit of a mix. It's political prosecution at its finest. And I think that's a point of this all. That's what one of the judges wrote this opinion about, how this is a political prosecution and should not be allowed to go forward. And, you know, I'm dealing with that specialty of it. But at the end of the day, does that mean we just stop fighting and we just fall back? No, I'm not doing that. Stacey, I've been back to Delaney multiple times, yes. Right? I've gone back. I've continued to have oversight. I continue to stand up for the people in my district and deliver back for my district, because that is the job that I signed up, you know, for. And at the end of this all, I want to make sure that I'm on the right side of this, of all of it, no matter what the personal sacrifice is.
Representative McIver, how can our audience support you in the fight ahead? I know supporting you financially, supporting you emotionally, but give us two or three things that they can do immediately to help support you and your pursuit of justice.
Absolutely. Well, one is to make sure you're uplifting this case and this situation, right? I think so many bad things are happening, especially in our news cycle. You know, we go to bed at night, Stacey, we wake up and it's like, you know, you're in wars and tariff wars and everything else. And so definitely would love if folks can make sure they're uplifting the case. They can join us in this fight, donate as little as $5 to the fight as well by going to LaMonicaForCongress.com and continue to stay up to par of what is happening, you know, with this case as we, you know, continue to fight it. So join me in the fight.
Thank you so much, Congresswoman LaMonica McIver, and thank you for standing up.
Thank you. Thank you, Stacey. It's good to see you.
You too. Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by Factor. A look at my calendar in the morning has me tired before lunch. Work, writing, and all of the in-betweens make meal prep one more chore between me and my bed. Enter Factor. Factor can help by delivering fully prepared meals designed by dietitians and crafted by chefs. It's one great way you can meet your nutrition goals this season, even when you can't fit in the planning, grocery runs, or cooking. Factor has meals built around your goals, whether that's overall nutrition, more protein, or GLP-1 support. For strength and workout recovery, check out Factor's Muscle Pro Collection. Every meal is crafted with functional ingredients: lean proteins, colorful vegetables, whole foods, and healthy fats. Factor bans 175 ingredients. No artificial colors or sweeteners, no high fructose corn syrup, just nutrient-dense food. And it's ready in 2 minutes. Factor shops, preps, cooks, and delivers straight to your door, so you have more time for everything you love. I like meals such as the Harvest Chicken Salad, a perfect meal for lunch where you want to feel satisfied and energized. Head to factormeals.com/assembly50off and use code assembly50off to get 50% off and free daily greens per box with a new subscription only, while supplies last until September 27th, 2026. See website for more details. Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by What If We Get It Right podcast. When it comes to climate change, have you ever wondered, what if we get it right? That question is the title of a podcast created by climate expert Dr. Ayanna Elizabeth Johnson. Listeners to my show know that to create a livable future here on planet Earth, we need to elect people who get it on climate. For the upcoming season of the What If We Get It Right podcast, Ayanna and her co-host, acclaimed journalist Bill McKibben, will focus on the politics of climate solutions. Every week through the midterms, these two will sit with expert guests to get to the heart of what's at stake in these elections and how the planet can win. They'll be covering everything from AI and energy bills to PACs for clean energy and protecting public lands, and how to get environmentalists to actually show up and vote. Look, things need to change. And as heat waves, wildfires, drought, sea level rise keep coming at us, we all need to hear from trusted voices. So join me and tune into What If We Get It Right with Ayanna and Bill as they break down climate solutions and help us see the ways forward. Find it online at getitright.earth/podcast or listen to What If We Get It Right wherever you get your podcast. California Attorney General Rob Bonta, welcome to Assembly Required.
Thank you, Stacey, for having me. I'm honored to be here and great to see you.
Likewise. Okay, so we're going to start with one of the 10 pieces of news you made like last week. But I want to start with the meta settlement, because what this does and what it means is seismic. And so I'd love for you to start just talking about why attorney generals thought that this was such an important case to bring and why this matters.
Absolutely. And, you know, as attorneys general, we're the chief law officers for our states, but we're also, you know, moms and dads. We have kids. We have kids who are on social media platforms, and we love them and want them to be healthy physically, mentally. And gratefully, I can say this has been an area of bipartisan priority. And so 51 attorneys general from across the country and some territories came together in a bipartisan fashion to protect the mental health of our children and to make sure that they are safe, that they're protected, that they're not being victimized by dangerous products that are designed and deployed to maximize their duration of use, frequency of use, and harm them in the process, creating anxiety and depression and addictive traits and learning loss and body image issues, all of the things that these products are known to create and visit that harm on them. So this is an area, maybe one of the fewer remaining vestiges, but one of the areas of bipartisan focus and concern. We teamed up to protect our kids and our future and to write a new chapter in what social media platforms are required to do to keep our kids safe. And we held Meta accountable here. There's much talk about the different aspects of the settlement agreement, including the financial component, but it is the injunctive relief that is the focus. That's what's most important. When we limit the amount of use daily to 2 hours, you know, with kids are on there 10, 12, 14 hours, seemingly all the time. And limiting it to 2 hours is a really important progressive step, as well as having blocks at night, blocks on notification in nighttime and school times when kids should be studying and sleeping, not scrolling, a block on cosmetic surgery filters, which in particular really harmed the mental health of young girls, the data showed, and blocks on likes and reactions to children's posts. So this is a whole suite, a whole constellation, if you will, of changes that I think will, I know, will reduce the harm to our kids going forward. And we hope will be a model, a blueprint, if you will, for the rest of the industry. Meta is a major player in this industry, but they're not the only player. So we want TikTok to adopt similar approaches. We want the same from YouTube, from Snap. So my long answer to your short question is, this is about protecting our kids and their health and their safety and their well-being.
Well, Rob, I remember the tobacco settlement. I remember when it came out. I remember just how seismic it was in how states approached the conversation of health and safety, especially for young people. And you just described the fact that, you know, while Meta has settled, that there are other tech tools out there that have not yet adopted or agreed. And we know that states and schools and teenagers have filed thousands of lawsuits against these companies. In practical terms, what happens next in terms of the implementation of these injunctive reliefs that you've been able to secure, but also how does this extend to and cover the TikToks and other, you know, technologies that were not party to these suits?
In short, we need to bring independent actions or get to independent agreements with each of the players in the industry. And we being broadly Republican and AG, Republican and Democratic states led by AGs across the country, have pending lawsuits now against TikTok. California has one now against TikTok. So there's that's in a more advanced stage when it comes to taking action with respect to TikTok. YouTube and Snap are in different places. But the hope is that we could come to some resolution, either without litigation or maybe through litigation or maybe, you know, while litigation looms, to get the other industry members to commit to this similar blueprint as Meta. And interestingly, in the settlement agreement that we have with Meta, there's a set of requirements that become stronger if other industry players sign on. So, for example, we have a 2-hour daily time limit on use of Instagram and Facebook. it becomes 1 hour if TikTok and YouTube and TikTok and YouTube sign on. So there's sort of an incentive built into the industry for them all to do more, but to do it together. I think their thinking is, and I don't subscribe to it, but I think their thinking is that if one of them is forced to follow a certain set of restrictions, limits, and conditions, and the others don't, then they're at a competitive disadvantage. I'd say you shouldn't be intentionally hurting kids and their mental health, no matter what position it puts you in vis-a-vis your competitors. But I know that's how they think, and I think that we could get something stronger if they all commit to a similar set of conditions.
Rob, one of the concerns I have about the settlement, and I'm delighted about the idea of creating more restrictions. I'd like to mention I have a borrowed teenager. My niece lived with me from the age of 14, and as long as she's in college, she's partially my responsibility. Oh. But it would have been fantastic for there to be a formal requirement that she not be able to be on social media all the time because my imploring did not work. However, I recently did an A block on Flock cameras, and I've written about it in local media. And here's my issue that, for these platforms to implement these stricter age controls, they are going to have to rely on meaningful age verification, biometrics, and other forms of identity tracking.
Yeah.
And I'd love for you to talk about how this settlement cuts against, protecting children's privacy, but coming at the expense of everyone's privacy because we're feeding the very same tech companies even more data and even more information with very few federal or state controls.
Yeah, I mean, therein lies the rub. And here we do have some additional requirements in our settlement agreement that is also a consent judgment, consent decree with ongoing oversight by the court that require age verification. One of our claims was that in violation of a federal law, Meta had children under age of 13 on their platform and we're using and collecting their data. We also have parental verification. And to your point, you need to gather more information to verify someone's age and to verify that they are the parent and not the child trying to bypass the restrictions and the limits. So we do think that it's important to be able to have appropriate age verification and age gating, as well as parent verification if a parent wants to override any of these restrictions. And then what we do with the what we require of the platforms once they have that additional data is going to be important as well. And in California, we have some of the strongest privacy protections. Each individual owns their privacy. They can opt out. They can request deletion. They can make sure it's not being sold. They can control who has it, what they do with it, how long they keep it, if they keep it at all. And so that's sort of the counterbalance to leave the control of people's private data in their own hands because it's theirs, not some company's.
Before we move to Paramount, which is also top of mind for me, I wanted to lastly touch on just the agility that your office has had to develop in attempting to regulate an industry that is evolving so rapidly. And as you mentioned, you are part of a coalition of attorneys general from around the country, but all of the technology that we're focusing on, or at least a fair amount of it, is generated and born in California. And that brings with it political challenges, political tensions. How do you navigate sort of the broader question about how to be agile and responsive with the fact that these are also constituents who rely on you for the kind of protections that any other citizen or resident of California would?
Yeah. We love our homegrown businesses. We're really proud of the fact, you'll hear me say it more than you want me to say it, that we're the fourth largest economy in the world here in California.
It's a point. I've never heard that, but go ahead.
My governor says it a lot. I like to say it a lot. It's a point of pride. We have so many incredible companies that have, founded here and grown here and succeeded here. And they're amazingly successful. And I'm pro-business and I'm pro-law and I'm pro-businesses that follow the law. And we believe that you can be wildly successful while you follow the law, that you can be wildly successful, Meta, YouTube, TikTok, Snap, and not hurt kids deliberately, not design products that are deployed to harm them, and that you lie to the world about them, saying that they're safe when you know they're not. You don't have to do that. You can still be successful without taking that step. So we're just requiring that our businesses succeed within the bounds of the law. And I think that that is foundational. The rule of law is good for everybody. It's good for businesses when you have property rights and contractual rights, when you can go to court, when you've been harmed and seek, you know, a civil remedy because of a violation of tort law. That's all good. We need rules of the road. Everyone needs to follow the same rules. It's also good for businesses that want to start up and create something, a better product, a better service. If they're squeezed out by monopolies and those who are price fixing and those who are manipulating the market, that's not good. So the law is good for business. The rules of the road are good for business, and we'd like to enforce them. And we demand that especially our local businesses, the ones that are founded here, that they're not violating the law. We want to be proud of them. We're proud when they are successful and when they're complying with the law. And I know they can be wildly successful while they do that. And so that's sort of how we see it. And I know that there, you know, maybe some of our local businesses feel that, you know, having their own attorney general with a law enforcement action against them doesn't feel quite right. But it's not anti them. It's not personal. It's just pro law and making sure the rules of the road are followed.
When we come back, more from my conversation with Rob Bonta. Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by Honeylove. I thought I couldn't do without underwires, and then I tried Honeylove. The new crossover contour bra is a great example of why wires aren't always necessary. It combines cloud fuse bonding with molded foam cups to help create a smooth, natural shape. What's cloud fuse bonding? It's a miracle of engineering to create a terrific bra. There are no wires involved, so there's no poking, digging, or pressure points. I've tried other no-wire options, but they never worked out. Honeylove got it right. Why? Because Honeylove is an independent, female-founded brand. All Honeylove products are intelligently designed by women who actually wear them, including the founder, Betsy, who is highly involved in the development of each product. Their bras are designed to provide lift and structure using innovative bonding technology instead of uncomfortable underwire, so you get that secured, lifted feel without the poking, pinching, or constant adjusting. And their Cloud Embrace bra is a game changer. Soft, breathable, and incredibly comfortable, but still supportive enough to make you rethink your underwire bras. Because comfort isn't a luxury, it's a requirement. And support shouldn't mean sacrificing how you feel in your own skin. And it doesn't stop at bras. Honeylove shapewear is especially worth calling out. It's designed to smooth and support without squeezing or restricting, using targeted compression that works with your body. Whether I'm at home, on calls all day, or on a speaking tour, Honeylove is a product that moves with me and keeps me comfortable all day long. Honeylove products use high-quality fabrics that feel great against your skin. Thoughtful touches like breathable materials make these pieces as practical as they are comfortable. At the end of the day, this isn't about changing your body. It's about supporting it in a way that actually feels good. And Honeylove delivers that at every stage. Treat yourself to the most advanced bras and shapewear on the market. Use our exclusive link to save 20% off Honeylove at honeylove.com/assembly. That's honeylove.com/assembly. After you check out, they'll ask where you heard about them. Please support our show and tell them we sent you. Experience the new standard in comfort and support with Honeylove. Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams is brought to you by Built. We've been talking about Built for a while now. And my question is, why didn't this exist sooner? Becoming a Built member means earning points on every housing payment. Rent, mortgage, it doesn't matter. You're paying it anyway, so you should get something back for it. Built points can be redeemed for flights, hotels, Lyft rides, Amazon.com purchases, future housing payments, and more. Personally, I'd use them for Built home delivery powered by GoPuff and at select restaurants. An unexpected benefit Built gives every member access to is its agentic neighborhood concierge in the Built app. It doesn't just give you information about your home and neighborhood, it executes. It's connected to your home and over 50,000 merchant partners, so you can ask it to pay your rent, make a dinner reservation, book a fitness class, schedule a lift, and more. It makes things happen while automatically applying your member benefits along the way. For a crowd that thinks a lot about what agentic AI actually looks like in practice, this is an example worth paying attention to. First, download the Built app. Second, link any credit or debit card to the app so purchases at your local spots become even more rewarding. And third, ask the neighborhood concierge in the app pretty much anything. It'll tell you about exclusive member benefits at restaurants, fitness studios, on your Lyft rides, and more around your home. And for the homeowners out there, Built works for mortgages too. Your housing payment is one of your biggest monthly expenses, so why wouldn't you want to earn points on it? Download the Built app and join the membership for where you live at joinbuilt.com/assembly. That's joinbuilt.com/assembly. And use our link so they know we sent you. Well, speaking of homegrown businesses that may face lawsuits, California, along with 11 other states, filed suit against the Paramount merger. And in full disclosure, I have a production company that is headquartered dually between California and Georgia. And this has been top of mind for so many of us because we agree with California's concerns that this merger leads to a monopoly state that will further constrain what is already a very narrowing universe of entertainment options in terms of production and writing and, you know, the business of entertainment. Can you talk about why this was so important to you? And I would love to, in your answer, to talk about why you think Europe has not seen quite the concern that you and your fellow AGs have raised.
Sure. You know, the issues that you raise are the issues that we were looking at when it comes to market concentration, market consolidation. We've seen historically a pattern of adverse impacts on the market, on consumers, for example. The prices go up and the quality of the goods or services that they get go down. There's a negative impact on jobs. Jobs get cut. Wages go down. Choice is more limited. Quality goes down, competition goes down when you have these massive mergers. And even more so when there is a consolidation in an already consolidated market. And there is already some consolidation in this market. Fox Disney was a merger that occurred a few years ago. And so when there's too much market power in the hands of too few, then you see a lot of these adverse impacts on the economy, on workers, on consumers, on affordability, which is top of mind for Americans, on prices. So, and there was a study recently in LA County that said if this merger is consummated, if it goes through, then there will be 5,000 to 10,000 plus jobs lost. There will be closing in on $3 billion in economic activity lost if the merger goes through. So that's what we're trying to protect Californians from and what the 12 AGs are trying to protect their constituents from. And this is just a, you know, bread and butter, black and white, meat and potatoes antitrust case where you look at the proposed merger and if it goes through, its impact on the markets. These are two entertainment titans that work across multiple markets. And if they merge, they will be an absolute entertainment behemoth. And in three specific markets, we've identified an unlawful market concentration that is presumptively illegal under federal longstanding, you know, century-old antitrust law, the Clayton Act, Section 7. And so we've just brought a straight-up antitrust case. And to your point about other regulators, there are other regulators who looked at this merger because these are, you know, global companies. And each of those regulators has a different set of authority, follows a different set of law, has a different geographic market, and has a different, you know, product and service market that is different than America's, which is the market that we're looking at. So just because something might pass the specific regulatory scrutiny in Mexico or the UK or Australia or the EU is really apples and oranges to the question of whether it passes regulatory scrutiny here in the United States. We looked at the impact of these two corporate behemoths on the American geographic market and the product and services market here. And we concluded with great specificity set forth in our complaint that they would it would lead to a presumptively unlawful merger in three different markets.
When you think about this merger and the consequences, one of the threats that was raised by the Ellisons was this threat that they would take Paramount out of California. And you just laid out the thousands of jobs, the billions of dollars that could be lost. How do you calibrate the decisions you're making? We have an earlier guest where we talked about risk assessment. How do you calibrate the potential harm against the potential good, especially when there's this very naked threat to what you see as a good being, you know, deliberately, you know, propagandized as a harm?
You know, we think that the only court that matters here is the court of law, and where we are going before a judge who sees all the arguments, sees the facts, sees the legal presentations, and makes decisions. And so far, we've been winning time and time again. We secured a temporary restraining order. We got the equivalent of a preliminary injunction that the Paramount stipulated to because they saw the writing on the wall and knew they were going to lose on the motion. And then we got the trial date that we wanted in March. And, you know, meanwhile, unfortunately, in my humble opinion, Paramount seems to be really going full speed and full court press in the court of public opinion. Mm-hmm. And in my humble opinion, advancing things that are irrelevant to the actual antitrust case, you know, talking a lot about what foreign regulators have done when the only regulators that matter are the ones here in America and the American market, talking about that, you know, if they spun off CNN, for example, and divested CNN, then that would resolve the concerns of the AGs. That's not true. It's never been true. It never will be true. They're talking about the streaming market a lot, which is not a market that we allege in our complaint. So there's the threat to leave. So here's how I see that. I see it as blackmail or extortion. It has nothing to do with this case. We're not seeking it. Nothing about our case would require it. I think that if they do decide to leave, which I don't think is impossible, you know, they would have to decide that on their own. And I don't poo-poo it at all. But it would have nothing to do with our case. It would lie at the feet of Mr. Ellison and the Paramount board. They would be responsible for it. They would have to own it. It would be a decision that they independently made free and clear of our litigation because our litigation does not require it. And they get no advantage in our litigation if they leave. We still maintain jurisdiction over this case, and this lawsuit continues. And Mr. Ellison has said that, you know, he's committed to Hollywood, its future. He wants to be in L.A. And with one side of his mouth, and with the other, he's saying, you know, we'll pick up our ball and leave if the attorneys general dare to enforce the law against this unlawful merger. So it's unfortunate that they have taken that position. I think because they've been losing in court so consistently, they're trying to manufacture, you know, invent some leverage by making something up that has nothing to do with the case. But I don't think it's, without any potential or possibility of happening. I don't want to poo-poo it, but it's just not relevant to this case. Bigger issues are important to Paramount staying in California, like a federal film tax credit that other nations have the equivalent of. I know Congress is talking about that now. I hope they land it. I 100% support it. A competitive California film tax credit that's competitive with the other state film tax credits is also important. Georgia has a great film tax credit. We've suffered to some degree from that great film tax credit in Georgia. New York does too. We should be as competitive as those tax credits. You know, I think they've taken the lid off the credit, no limit. And they've also included some above-the-line costs as part of the film tax credit. I highly encourage California to consider the same to create the most robust and supportive environment for, you know, our iconic Hollywood.
We spend a lot of time on the show talking about authoritarianism. And the reason I am so bullish about it is that we have to translate what people hear about in sort of headlines into what it feels like in real life. That authoritarians like to seize your power. They hoard that power to the wealthy and the oligarchs and the other powerful people that they know, and they try to evade responsibility for how that power is used. They follow this 10-step plan that has worked from, you know, Hungary to Turkey to India to Bolivia and Brazil. And those 10 steps to authoritarianism always, always, always involve overreach, overstepping, but taking such an aggressive approach that people feel outmatched by what is happening. But if there are 10 steps to authoritarianism and autocracy, there are 10 steps to freedom and power. And step 5 that we talk about is litigation. And you are a one-person litigation machine, I think, in just over 18 months in your role as AG. California has filed 82 lawsuits against this administration and this regime, leading or co-leading 55 of them. You know, your office has filed more than 120 amicus briefs supporting other cases against the administration. And you've been successful. You've secured 45 orders, granting early relief, 21 final orders. You've also scared them out of court. They've just dropped the cases. And you have not constrained yourself on the topics. You've fought on issues like immigration, voting rights, public safety, environmental protections, federal funding. Why are you so bullish? And what do you want people to understand about why this level of engagement matters?
Well, let me just first say thank you for how powerfully and consistently you speak about oligarchy and fascism and autocracy and the threats and how you make it real for people. You do that better than anyone. And that's so critical to how we respond and how we rise up as people across this country. And I have a special lane. I have a set of authority that I am given by being the Attorney General, the Chief Law Officer, a constitutional position here in California that I cherish and I'm honored for, and I see it as a privilege and a gift to have, and I want to use it for good. And I deeply believe in the rule of law, and I have taken a position along with my incredible team here. We're 1,200 attorneys, almost 6,000 staff, as well as AGs across this country. Unfortunately, mostly or almost essentially Democratic attorneys general across the country, to say to the president, the Trump administration, that you are not allowed to break the law, violate the Constitution, and hurt our states ever, period, full stop. And so the Trump administration decides if we sue and when we sue. If they break the law, we sue them. If they follow the law, we don't. It's really that simple. And litigation that lifts up and protects and defends our Constitution, the rule of law, the separation of powers, checks and balances, rights and freedoms, all the things that are enshrined in our in the foundations of our democracy, that is a check on oligarchy. It's a check on autocracy. It's a check on fascism. So we go to court to protect the foundations of this country. And the Trump administration is trying to erode them. Make them go away, trying to usurp power he doesn't have, seize power he doesn't have, seize Congress's power, seize the state's power, blow through the law and the Constitution and not to let the court stop him. But our bread and butter and our North Star is the law and the facts. And when we think the law and the facts are on our side and this administration has broken the law, we go to court. And that has been an effective guardrail in cabining this administration from exceeding the boundaries of its authority and seizing more authority. So we're grateful that we've brought the many lawsuits that we've brought. They've covered a lot of things, yes, from fundamental voting rights, the right from which all of the rights flow, to protecting the constitutional right of birth citizenship, pushing the lawfully federalized and deployed National Guard out of our states, striking down tariffs that raise the cost for Americans twice, protecting California's Prop 50, which was our clap back on redistricting after Trump said he was entitled to 5 more seats in Texas, and Governor Abbott was happy to provide that to him. And so we've delivered on very meaningful issues. We protected $200 billion worth of funding for housing and healthcare and food and public education and disaster relief. And we see our role and going to court and bringing these lawsuits as a way to protect the foundational pillars of this American democracy.
More from my conversation with Rob Bonta after the break.
I'm Nate Silver.
I'm Galen Druk.
And I'm Claire Malone.
We're back, this time with our friends at Crooked Media for a new show called
Still Counting. Yeah.
Numbers are hard, takes are easy.
And frankly, numbers have only gotten harder.
What does the data actually say? How do we reconcile that with the other things that we're seeing in American politics and around the world? And how do we use that data to understand or maybe even dare to predict the future of American politics?
New episodes every Wednesday starting September 9th. Subscribe to Still Counting on youtube.com/@stillcountingpodcast or wherever you get your podcasts.
Well, Rob, one more question for you. And this one goes to something you've been a champion of, and you have been a stalwart on this topic. In fact, you are currently in the midst of an ex-contretemps with a fellow law enforcement officer in California about the weaponization of mail-in voting, this fiction of non-citizen voting, which does not happen in America at any degree. And often when it does occur, it is by mistake because we do not have a single set of rules. We have 50 different states with 50 different sets of rules. We know that mail-in voting is critical. It's critical for the elderly, for the disabled. It is critical for students. It is critical for people who no longer have agrarian jobs where they can show up on a Tuesday. And in California, it is built into the nature of democracy. So can you give our listeners just a shorthand on what the most current Supreme Court decision said and didn't say about mail-in voting, and why you have been such a champion of protecting this very important tool for democracy?
Absolutely. And in California, we have universal vote by mail. We think it's important to remove obstacles and barriers to the fundamental right to vote, and that we bring the franchise closer to people and people participate in our democracy. Eligible voters, obviously, of course, that makes us a stronger democracy, a more robust democracy. And there is no widespread voter fraud. It is a conspiracy theory. It's a figment of the imagination. And Trump very dangerously and wrongly continues to advance this theory that, you know, vote by mail is cheat by mail or whatever he says, and that that he won the 2020 election. You know, meanwhile, he's the one asking the Secretary of State for Georgia to find, you know, 11,000 plus votes and seizing ballots in Fulton County and encouraging January 6th to undermine the free and fair certification of Joe Biden. And he's also issued multiple executive orders to try to undermine vote by mail. He had one that we struck down and continues to be struck down, which prevented timely cast vote by mail ballots from being counted if they arrived after Election Day. We won on that. That is not the law. And then we're also challenging an executive order where he's trying to create essentially a citizenship list administered and maintained by the United States Postal Service. And vote by mail ballots can't move through the United States Postal Service if you're not on that list that the federal government maintains. And, you know, what could go wrong with that? We believe it's a blatantly unlawful executive order, and that the final rule that the U.S. Postal Service advanced is unlawful because the time, place, and manner of elections as set forth in the U.S. Constitution's Elections Clause is determined by the states and to a degree Congress, not the president. He has zero authority, and not the United States Postal Service. They don't have authority. Their job is ministerial, to move mailable items through the U.S. Postal Service, not determine which ones will move and which ones won't. Vote by mail ballots, of course, are mailable. The U.S. Supreme Court, on the emergency docket, which they've been using more and more, some call it the shadow docket, last week, I think it was last Monday, basically just said that the case that the attorneys general brought challenging this executive order regarding vote by mail by the president, that we brought it too early, that it was premature. They didn't address the substance. In fact, they said this does not address the substance. And we then immediately filed a case that was consistent with the Supreme Court's position on timeliness. And the next day we got a restraining order blocking the United States Postal Service's final rule that would use the citizenship list. That remains the case today. The final rule of the United States Postal Service is blocked because of our action. A federal judge in the District of Massachusetts. We're briefing now a 14-day temporary restraining order. We're briefing now a more robust preliminary injunction. We'll have that hearing on Thursday. And meanwhile, secretaries of state and elections officials are trying to figure out what their vote by mail ballots are supposed to look like, because they're trying to send them out now, this week. Yeah. This is so close to an election.
Yeah.
And there's a rule called the Purcell rule, which basically says courts should not get involved in changing the rules of an election so close to an election. And we think that we're in that space right now, that the block on this United States Postal Service's final rule should remain in effect through the pendency of the election in November. But I think they'll still continue to try to advance this policy past this November, into 2028 and into future elections. So the fight might not be done, and it's not done now. This could go up to the U.S. Supreme Court. They could take this up on the substance. And we think it's an open shut case that the president of the United States Postal Service just has no authority to do what they're trying to do, interfering with vote by mail in America.
Rabanta, you are an exceptional attorney general, but you and I met in law school. And so we both know a little bit of something about homework. And one thing that we do here on Assembly Required is we give our audience homework. So you are the embodiment of step five litigating. But I like to tell our audience that litigation doesn't mean going to court alone. So if you have one thing that they can do that helps them make the case about why the work that you do, the work that we are doing in opposition to authoritarianism works, what's one task you would give folks?
Well, what I'd like to say to folks that are watching, to your many, many viewers, is one, don't feel hopeless, because we're not helpless. Stay engaged with what's happening, and stay enraged about the blatant violations of the law that the Trump administration is engaged in. And remember that people power is the most potent power that there is in our democracy. And now, leading up to this election, is the time to exercise it. If you feel that what's happening with the interference by the Trump administration in the vote by mail process and election integrity generally is something you don't support, if you think that what the AGs are doing, fighting for rights and freedoms and checks and balances, is something you do support, exercise that most foundational and most potent power that we have by voting. And thank you for tuning in to listen a little bit about what we're doing for people across this country. I'm proud and honored to be the Attorney General of California, grateful for my amazing team and the Attorney Generals that we get to fight with on issues that are meaningful to you, to our state, and to our country.
California AG Rabanta, thank you so much for joining me today on Assembly Required.
My honor. Great to see you, Stacey. Thanks for
Likewise.
Having me.
Give me my best.
I will.
As always, at Assembly Required, we give you actionable tools to help make a difference. First, be curious. 2 weeks ago, a major storm hit Indiana and other parts of the Midwest, and this resulted in 7 deaths and caused what the North Indiana Public Service Commission, or NIPSCO, called the worst damage in known company history. Gary, Indiana, a majority Black city with 29% of the population living in poverty, suffered the worst damage in the state, with tens of thousands left without power for more than 2 weeks. And as of yesterday, hundreds more are still waiting. What's worse is that in the early days of the blackout, Gary, Indiana, was left off of NIPSCO's timelines for power restoration in the state. And it watched neighboring communities get updates about their power while receiving nothing. This has left the mayor and others with understandable questions about why one of the state's most vulnerable communities was not being prioritized. And residents have begun organizing a class action lawsuit. As the climate crisis continues and extreme weather events intensify, poor communities and communities of color are often the hardest hit. And the consequences in Gary are dire, and they will repeat. Unfortunately, spoiled food in an area where hunger is already an issue is just one of the issues. The loss of temperature-controlled medication, oxygen machines, and mobility devices that get cut off, and asthmatics left without nebulizers, all in the midst of extreme heat. This is real. So I need us to be curious. I want us to dive into coverage from outlets like Black-led outlet Capital B News, Also, you can turn to CBS, CNN, NBC, or an op-ed in MS Now from Karen Freeman Wilson, former mayor of Gary and current president and CEO of the Chicago Urban League. By reading more, we can learn more about how and why this crisis is happening, and we will link to several of these in the show notes. Next, we're going to solve problems. Visit gary.gov/stormrecovery to give to the Storm Recovery Fund. The Urban League of Northwest Indiana's Facebook page also has opportunities to get involved, particularly with organizations providing food relief. And then let's do some good. Relief Gang is an excellent grassroots organization that has been addressing the crisis from the very beginning. So follow them on Instagram at Relief Gang to see if they have upcoming food drives and to monitor their other opportunities to help. And I want to say thank you to those of you who share questions and comments via my Substack, Assembly Notes, Crooked Media's Discord channel, or other platforms. As you know, when you like, subscribe, and share, you feed the algorithm and help others find their way here. So do me a huge favor and keep the questions and comments coming. And if you like what you hear, tell others about us and add us to your feed. We keep growing. We're closing in on 100,000 subscribers on YouTube, and that's because of your help. So however you listen or watch, make sure you show your support and bring your friends. Then let me know which episodes resonate and what you want to learn more about. That wraps up this episode of Assembly Required with Stacey Abrams. Do good out there, and I'll meet you here next week. Assembly Required is a Crooked Media production. Our show is produced by Elena Minkowski and Farrah Safari with Katie Long and Adrian Hill. Our team includes Matt DeGroat, Ben Heathcoat, Kirill Polaviv, Jordan Cantor, Charlotte Landis, and Jay Banks. Our staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Hey, it's John. Last year, 2,500 people joined us at CrookedCon for conversations with some of the smartest organizers, least annoying politicians, and most interesting voices in politics about how to fix this mess. We're doing it again November 5th through the 7th in Washington, D.C. with even more podcast panels and workshops. Plus, there will be drinks, which we'll need after the midterms, no matter which way they go. Get your tickets at CrookedCon.com, where we'll also announce the lineup. If you're a Friends of the Pod subscriber, a limited number of discounted tickets are still available. Get them before they run out. See you at CrookedCon.